what do you think? I mean, what direction do you think we want to go in now?
I like the idea, no, I like to be the name, which is important. Breakfast with Park.
Okay.
A Leitrim man and a Corkman discuss the rising.
Right. Yeah, nice to know. Of course, we never use it. We never use that f***ing to do it.
To the 50s, there would have been some kind of plebiscite.
And it would have happened.
And it would have happened. I don't know.
That's true.
No, exactly. Should the farmers work badly off? The farmers all had their land by 1960. Didn't it?
There's not a
poor people, wasn't there? It was, but I suppose economics is a different thing in some respects. Because we could be economically well off under the Brits.
Yeah.
So what did we gain? You know, or you could be worse off. I mean, governments change, governments come and go. Was it Liam Meadows said, we just exchanged Tweedy Dum for Tweedy Dee?
When did he say that?
When?
Yeah.
I don't know, but somebody told me that. I think I heard it in the pub one night.
Certainly I'm an expert on the impact it has had on me.
It doesn't matter really, anyway, on the
shut.
We might have had that plebiscite. And
that's
wonder,
true.
I bet you if Ireland had plebiscite, it would have been defeated again.
I bet it would have.
After 100 years.
Well, they
wouldn't have taken the risk.
Yeah,
there was no place more conservative than the Irish.
I don't think we're any more conservative than other societies.
Yeah, did got you. Get that into you.
Where are you going to
park your sausage?
Where are you going to cook the sausages?
But yeah, I suppose it always fascinated me. I think on April 24, 1916,
yeah,
that was Easter Monday, 1916, Pearse read the proclamation, came out on the steps of the GPO and read the proclamation at about 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
But on April 24th, 1916, at 12:30, a half an hour later, apart from the time difference obviously, Crean and his buddies pushed off in the James Caird from Elephant Island. Which I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have these two things chronicled. We've what happened at 12 o'clock on April 24, 1916, and we've what happened in diary at 12:30, half an hour later, in the South Pole.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of Crane's story. And I suppose he kind of made the connection. There was one Irishman, Crane, heading off to the pole as a member of the British Navy.
Yeah.
And you had Barry Pierce, another Irishman.
Yeah.
A bit. I think he was born Irishman.
Striking a blow for Ireland against the same British
establishment that Crane was an employee of. You know, you just, it's interesting how their lines diverged, I suppose. And
of course, they didn't start from the same point. Crane started from poverty in West Kerry.
Yes, yeah.
You know, yeah, that's true. A farmer, a small farmer. Whereas Pierce, as you said, was born in England.
I think.
Yeah. He was middle class, I suppose.
Well, he was.
He was an educator.
That's right.
And then Crane left school at 14 or so.
That's right. He joined up at 14 or so.
Yeah.
Like a lot of fellas at the time, Petter. My uncle was always on about the poor old soldiers at Killeen's.
Did you write about that?
Yeah, I've been poor about that.
Go on, give it to us.
What?
Give it to us.
They died in the ditches. Not at the Somme, but in rural Cork. A shell's arc from Shandon and Collins barracks. Then the man, John Downey, Dinish Fleming. They knew of Gallipoli and the Ardennes, but lived to recount tales to the farmer in exchange for a few pennies. Or a feed of potato and dripping. 3 days work on the milk cart. Or a week saving hay. No army jobs for them. A post in the civic guard. No one to write or follow up with the Crown Forces office in London. They staved off hunger with cheap stout and cases. Rambled the roads, retelling stories of the dead heat in Mesopotamia or the souks of Basra. The boys playing pitch and toss at Killeen's crossroads. They died in their breeches, unknown and unloved. By free state or king, no poppies for them at Windsor.
Hey, all history is speculation to a degree, but I mean, would you consider yourself an expert?
I'm an expert on how the 1916 Rising has impacted me. Nearly.
With the focus of being on the Irish?
Yeah.
They might have succeeded in teaching us Irish.
Chances are, because we wouldn't have had independence, the focus would have been on cultural things.
Yes, that's true.
That's an interesting thing. We could be speaking Irish now.
And implemented with a bit more precision.
Yeah.
A bit more...
just like Welsh, you know?
Yeah. That's a good point, isn't it? Brit Stay would be speaking Irish.
This is a project to look at 1916.
Yes, yeah.
And I suppose celebrate your saying rather than commemorate.
But yeah, I was thinking, I mean, really we should be kind of celebrating the birth of a nation.
Yeah.
Regardless of, you know, people have horrendous lives, but yet they celebrate their birthday. You know, it's an occasion to be born and to come into the world. And I mean, I suppose, in the same way, even though you can criticise the Irish state as it is today, and what it is now, we should still be celebrating what was made at the time, and the sacrifice that was given over, even if it was foolhardy, even if we think it's foolhardy. Some people really put a lot of energy into creating something new.
Yeah.
And the ideas were there.
Yeah.
It's been thwarted, maybe, you can argue.
Yeah.
But, and the birth of freedom. I mean, the birth of freedom, is that, did we achieve any more freedom? Maybe we didn't, but certainly it was a good thing. I think it was a good thing. It was a good thing. It was an admirable thing to do and strive for. And I don't think, well, some of the people who did that may have their own personal dysfunctions, which is really kind of 2016 analysis.
Yeah.
You know, it is. They still I don't think we're greedy people.
Yeah.
I think the motivations were inherently good.
Yeah.
Now, the people that came after, the people who took over the first thought and the second thought, they were probably much more jumped on the bandwagon, they were much more conservative, much more people there to take power and to rule. But I think the initial guys weren't, that wasn't their intention. So what about your poem? You've written a poem, that poem about the hats.
Me, that poem, I was sitting beach on Vance Kelly's, and I think I came up with the line, is that what they died for, to wear my hats?
Okay.
You know, and I was just thinking, we were probably talking, so.
I collect the fragments from folklore history, two tired pictures a millennia old. The first is a sepia, smaller and fragile. I put on gloves and measure both. In the second photo, the people are hatless. Suits and dress sense seem little changed. Walking casually down Grafton Street, the men are bearded in each frame. No sign of umbrellas, the day is dry. The genders are balanced, the ages mixed. Social strata appear equivalent, a beggar appearing in both prints. The buskers maintain the same location. One is a zither, the other a mandolin. In front of a cafe with preserved facade, from window tables, middle-class women drink coffee, gaze out, each at their circumstance. They seem to be asking, as if in a dream, was that what they died for, to wear no hats? There are no flags flying on either scene.
You know what I was thinking?
Yeah.
The bad light. The more homegrown this is, the better in a way. Isn't it?
It's going to be fantastic, so. And like really, like the 16 wasn't really about the state of Ireland at the time, was it? It was about the famine, it was about the past.
That's true.
You know?
Well, the Fenians grew up out of the famine, you know, and they were those who ultimately led it. So, did their mindset change?
What is it wrong? What is it wrong to fight for freedom? You want to free your people?
It's plans for freedom, isn't it? And that's freedom. Like a lot of people at the time, they were free. They were happy with what they had.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Like what happened up in the north was terrible. In that, there was partition and the British left the unions in the north.
To run it.
Yeah. Created a segregated, discriminatory society.
Yes.
70 years.
Yeah.
Whereas if Ireland had stayed united under the throne, that possibly wouldn't have happened.
That's true. Yeah.
So that wouldn't have happened. All the deaths up in the north wouldn't have happened, maybe. Then you don't know.
Yeah.
For me, growing up, that yellow stained proclamation hung on the stairs, and I passed it going up to bed every night and coming down the stairs every morning. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies, to be sovereign and indefeasible. But that didn't seem to me to be how it was, and every morning the radio told of another killing on the falls, or the Shankill, or a timed explosion with no warning given, or an incendiary device in a drapery shop in Craigavon, or Portadown, Down, or Newry.
Any other festival where you had marching bands and parades on the main street of the town on Sunday, and that piece I wrote is to try and capture that marching band and the impact it has on people. And of course they were playing nationalist songs, anthems like A Nation Once Again, and that's one of the big that's one of the songs I remember most. It had a big impact on me, not particularly from the words or from what I was saying. I don't think I was aware, but just the tune and the energy behind it, and to hear that marching band tuning up and then kicking off and coming up through the town. And it had an impact on me, as an 8, 9, 10 year old boy, but I'm sure it had an impact on everyone else who stood and watched and listened. And the impact, it's hard to tell, but probably a conflict. There was the national anthem, people were aware of it, they were getting energized by that national anthem. But yet, conscious of what was going on in the background at the time, which was obviously the troubles in Northern Ireland. So that has created a conflict, I think, in a lot of Irish people.
Paddy Mulvey, on his last run of the day from the pit, drives up Mill Hill and pulls to a halt in the middle of the square. In front of Jimmy's and in front of Shanks and across from Keelty's, his metal-sided tipper truck discharges its cargo. Miners with black caps, black clothes, black faces with white eyes peeking and black lunch bags strapped across their shoulders, carrying black sandwiches to be eaten with black hands and white teeth. One by one they jump off the back of the truck and get onto Honda 50s, or into cars, or go into Keelty's, or Mackey's, or go into Jimmy's for a paper or a cone or Silverman's, or into Shanks for a steak, and up to Healy's for the onions to bring home. And Paddy, a tidy, short, square, pipe-smoking, tight bit of a man in suit and boots dulled from coal dust, calm and consistent, drives off and parks in his usual spot across from his house, just at the top of Hilly Road, facing the town. And maybe walk down and go into Carty's for a half on and water. I could see the lorry from the high street. It was always there, the very same spot, teetering on the top of the hill, it seemed. Just planked there, turned and ready for the off in the morning, if the handbrake ever went. It was in the square where miners disgorged that the pipe band started up when leading the parade and on Postal Sunday. In front of Jimmy's they'd line out on warm-up, black furry hats high in white spats, and squawk and drone and drum roll until they were all ready in formation, and then magically with a distinct tight drum roll they'd start up, and the pipes would cut in with a long breathless drone and they'd move off in unison, and everybody sung along in their heads.
When boyhood's fire was in my blood, I dreamt of ancient freemen of Greece and Rome, who bravely stood, 300 men and free men.
They'd progress up Low Street, followed by the boxers in singlets and gloves, and the under-12 football team, and a fancy dress led by Pocahontas, and stop in front of the stage erected for the occasion, and salute Morris O'Doherty, the newsreader from RTE, in his blue trench coat buttoned to the neck, who was opening the show.
A nation once again, a nation once again, and Ireland long a province be, a nation once again.
Then move on up past the bank, and Ryan in the doorway, and past Crofts and Healy's, and past the sergeant in his short sleeves, stopping traffic at the turn for Carrick, droning and whining and drum rolling, and wheel around in front of the barracks and come back down again. And when it will be over and the stage abandoned, empty chairs in disarray, and the crowd dispersing reluctantly, leaving in their wake chip bags for the crows and ice cream wrappers, Bernie Paul would get up at the microphone and play on the mouth organ. Hairy Mary had a canary up the leg of her drawers. When she was leaping, I was beeping up the leg of her drawers.
A nation once again, a nation once again, and Ireland long a province be, a nation once again.
Hello? On one wall you had a picture of Parnell, another wall you had the proclamation.
Yeah.
So you had these two things going on. Maybe you had the Democrat and the militarist.
Well, like, had they been hanging there a long time?
Oh, forever. Like, the picture of Parnell is there since day dot.
Is that still up there?
It's an old picture of Parnell.
Yeah.
you know, kind of a printer, you know. Yeah, they're still there, we still have that.
But that's what, like, in my house, like, there was no picture parallel, obviously. But yeah, there was no proclamation either, although my father was Fianna Fáil side of the argument for, and I think my grandmother was in the common man.
Oh, as well.
So, like, there was a Sacred Heart picture in my house, like, obviously, it still isn't.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, different families and different things, you know?
Yes, yeah. It's, yeah, it's just fascinating.
There would have been no political pictures of.
Now, I think Sean McDiarmid spoke in our house. He stayed in
Sean McDiarmid, let them hear that.
Yes, of the Brabant Legion, yeah.
Well, it probably one of the best Lord members, really, isn't he?
Sean McDiarmid?
Yeah. Countess Markovic was upper class, obviously, Anglo-Irish. Maud Gonne was English. Connolly obviously came from a very different background. He came from a very poor background, grew up in England in poverty.
Yeah, look, Pierce is up there, but Sean McEwan was probably the main organiser.
Joseph Mary Plunkett.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah.
Grace, what was her name again?
Grace Gifford.
Gifford, who married Joseph Mary Plunkett in Mountjoy Jail, was it?
Kilmaina.
In Kilmaina?
Yeah. When he was...
Oh, yeah, it was at Kilmaina, they were all shot.
Yes, yeah.
Mountjoy Jail, one Monday morning, high upon the gallows tree, Kevin Barry gave his young life for the cause of liberty. Just a lad of 18 summers, and yet no man can deny, as he walked to death that morning, he proudly held his head on high.
The men who made a poetry film for Ireland.
Die for Ireland. What do you think? What's the chances?
Would you do it?
No. I suppose
you wouldn't go. You wouldn't go and take that.
Yeah.
Well, that's true too.
Circumstances allowed it, would it, don't they?
I suppose
people dictates everything.
Yes, yeah. Depends on how much you have to lose, isn't it?
How much you have to lose, how much you have to gain.
Yeah.
Anyhow,
okay.
You're nice and making it. You're making some fantastic breakfasts.
Thanks very much.
If you were to sit down now, which of the signatories would you like to sit down with for breakfast? Do you know anything about any of them?
Well, I tell you, not really. You see, you think you do. You think you do, but then you ask me a question and I won't be able to answer it. You know? I mean, I think Connolly would have been the person that fascinated me most. I don't know, is that because he's the leftist? I don't really know. I would have done some work on Connolly or read about Connolly. But I think actually Thomas MacDonagh, now, since you discovered that poem,
yeah,
that kind of fascinates me. I'd like to know more about him.
Basically, we were looking for a poem to make a portrait film about. And I showed it to Connor. Connor really liked it. Yeah, it's a kind of an evocative piece. Of the time, ballad-like, I would say. And it was obviously written before 1916. But it's got it poses some interesting social questions about its traveller and the relationship between a traveller and a settled woman. And, you know, the taboo that existed at the time about it. And I suppose one of the interesting things was that MacDonagh would maybe have the presence of mind to tackle such a subject. And secondly, what was interesting to me is that 100 years later, freedom and everything, and 95 years of having a free state stroke republic, that taboo would still be very much in evidence and still exist in Irish society. I'm not an expert in MacDonagh, to be honest. I'm not forgetting half the things I read about him already, but you know, it's just interesting to look at what they wrote, because through their writing sometimes maybe we'll understand what motivated them.
There doesn't seem to be much social commentary from the other leaders about conditions and life at that time. They talk about a United Ireland. All their goals and aims seem to be quite aspirational and high-minded, as opposed to changing things like that, tolerance or intolerance. McDonagh seems to be the only one that has produced stuff like that. Is that?
Well, to be honest, I don't know. I haven't researched it enough, and I'd probably. You know, before we took on this project, we should have probably researched it. But this isn't a history. This isn't a history lesson. This is just ordinary people's views, and maybe the effect the rising had on us. Now, you know, if you look at the declaration or the proclamation, it's very aspirational, but it's talking about equality, and it's talking about you know, suffrage for women. All Irish men and women equal, you know, and talking about the British, you know, creating divisions in Irish society, and it's talking obviously about the North and the Ulster Unionists and the Catholics there, and minorities is talking about as well. So, you know, they must have been thinking about these things, but it seems that a number of the leaders obviously came from different backgrounds. Now, Connolly obviously came from a very different background. He came from a very poor background, grew up in England in poverty. I'm not sure really, but I think that most of the other leaders probably weren't from very poor backgrounds.
Yes, that's
they were true. Probably kind of, you know, lower middle class Catholic backgrounds. So
they didn't have the socialist tendency, would you think, that Connolly had?
No, well, I mean, obviously they weren't really socialists. And you know, I think there's different arguments about there's a kind of a socialist feel to the proclamation, and is that what Connolly brought into it?
Yes, I wonder about that. Yeah.
But you know, they weren't socialists, and like I suppose Connolly was driven to this rising and this nationalist rising, I suppose, after years of getting nowhere with his socialist fighting, really.
That's true, yeah. That's really bad.
So, you know, I think it was at the time, wasn't it? I mean, you know, there was kind of independence movements throughout Europe.
I dreamt last night of you, John, and to heart you called to me. And why not walk this morning, John, yourself I hope to see. But I was all alone, John. Though still I heard your call. I put my boots and bonnet on, and took my Sunday shawl, and went full shore to find you, John, at Nina Fair. The fair was just the same as then 5 years ago today, when first you left the Thimblemen and came with me away. For there again were Thimblemen, and shooting galleries, and card trick men, and Maggie men, of all sorts and degrees, but not a sight of you, John, was anywhere. I turned my face to home again and called myself a fool, to think you'd leave the Thimblemen and live again by rule, to go to Mass and keep the fast until the little patch. My wish to have you home was past before I raised the latch and pushed the door and saw you, John, sitting down there. How cool you came in here, begad, as if you owned the place. And but rest yourself there now, my lad. 'Tis good to see your face. My dream is out, and now by it I think I know my mind. At 6 o'clock this house you'll quit, and leave no grief behind. But up till 6 o'clock, John, my bit you'll share. The neighbour's shame of me began when first I brought you in, to wed and keep a tinker man, they thought a kind of sin. But now, 'tis 3 years since you've gone, 'tis pity me they do. And that I'd rather have, John, than that they'd pity you. Pity for me and you, John, I could not bear. Oh, you're my husband right enough, but what's the good of that? You know you never were the stuff to be the cottage cat, to watch the fire and hear me lock the door and put out shit. But there now, it is 6 o'clock and time for you to step. God bless and keep you far,
John John. And that's my prayer.
I think Pierce was too idealistic. Okay, he was needed.
Yeah.
It is drive and verve was needed. I think Connolly, idealistic also, but in a particular, but probably lacking, maybe lacking a certain flavour.
Yeah.
But I think McDonough, he's the poet and he's a realist at the same time. He's combining both of those things, and I think that's interesting. Because you can't have a society without poetry. You can't
have... Do you know anything about Kent?
No. No, who didn't go through the same...
No, yeah, Sean McDermott in there. Like, if,
you know, I know Sean McDermott, he's from your area.
Clark, he
was the oldest guy, wasn't he?
Yes.
And he was an old Fenian, he'd been in jail for a long time.
That's right, yeah.
McDonough, you know all about, he was a lecturer.
Yeah, Pierce.
Yes, you know about, he was a teacher.
Connolly.
Who's Kent? Tell me something about Kent.
Do not know anything about him except the train station Cork was named after.
He's trying to figure out a player to remove it.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting, I found that out when reading
Inspect
that in the GPO that Connolly was the military man. He was giving the military orders. He was the only one with military experience.
Oh, well, that's true. You saw it.
Yeah, he was a soldier, British Army.
Yeah.
And again, that had been something, a key time in his life when he was a soldier of the British Army. He was stationed in Ireland.
Right.
And I think he was guarding someone, an Irish rebel at some point, who was executed.
My understanding, and I read this somewhere, but it doesn't fully gel with his British Army career, but that he was actually put out of a job when he turned 18.
Yeah. Why?
Because he would have to be paid a proper wage.
Well, should they do that today? Like, I mean, you know, the you know, people have only a 15-hour-a-week contract and they can't get mortgages, even though they might be working 30, 40 hours a week for years. Their contract says it's a 15-hour. They can be cut down at any stage to 15 hours. They can't get social welfare because it's all, it could be over 5 days. They can't claim family.
It could be spread out over 5 days.
Income support, yeah.
Well,
like, you know,
well,
you know, they, you know, these are the things that Connolly fought and died for.
Yeah. I mean, it's not improving. It's not improving from the 50s, or it's not improving from, let's say, the 70s, which was the heyday of the blue-collar worker.
Yeah.
It has gone downhill since. Yeah. You know, the wages, the value for money that you can get from your wages, so therefore standard of living is continually on the decrease.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you can live now a lot cheaper. Food is a lot cheaper. The amount of money that you have to spend on food now is a lot less than you've had to spend on percentage-wise of your income.
What do you think?
I mean, it's a fact.
Mm. Would you need 2 wage brackets to buy a house?
Yeah, but basically, you know, the maintenance, you have cars, you have holidays, you have multi-channel, you have all these utility bills, you know. They're charging you for everything, you know.
But you could buy your whole house on 1 wage bracket and raise a family on 1 wage bracket and leave the wife there and all.
That's a first.
The middle classes are mourning again. Not blood this time, but water. Frothing at the mouth with the thought of paying. You knew the men who paid with their lives. The four terrible fathers. MacDonagh, Connolly, Kent and MacBride. Did they consider their sons' futures, their daughters' dowries? No. They were revolutionaries. Mad Markovitch and you hobnobbing with them. Upper class girls off to a ball. But you were organising long before that. Marching after the Empire's coffin. With Connolly and Yeats. Casting eviction scenes onto city walls. De-commemorating the Queen's Jubilee. Do you think more that there's a God who walks among the dead? Among those heroes who gave their lives. And you, their beautiful muse, but a terrible mother, or so they say.
You need two bed packets in every house. If you want to buy a house,
if you want to buy a house, that's necessary.
You need two bed packets.
You can't do that.
That seems to be the way anyway. To have a standard of living that everyone else has, but
that's liberal capitalism. Right? That's capitalism, right? They're driving everybody to work harder to buy things they don't need.
Exactly. That's it.
Are your opinions conflicting and contradictory? In one voice you say things are great, and then on another subject you say things are terrible. Is this typical of people's views today? Yeah, people never seem to be happy. Why isn't everybody happy with the way we are? They look back at the past and they see that we've progressed, and yet they're always giving out about everything. Why can't we just see that 1916 was a fantastic success and things have been wonderful?
Well, I suppose they're not wonderful. It's certainly not wonderful for everybody, and the facts bear that out. I think a lot of it is in control. If you control that, you get it in slowly, like, but... Yeah. Imagine there should be a button that you press that would just do it for you.
Party now.
Okay.
Try it. Shite. Yeah, that's recording, and it was like...
Somebody's golden Labrador retriever with the brown collar was jumping up at the window in the kitchen, trying to eat a blue bottle. Growling with head lowered, the dog would step back, then pounce at the window open mouth. With his paws on the low sill, he'd snap sideways at the fly, buzzing and banging off the glass. Music was coming from the front bar, and the potatoes were boiling on the back ring. Emmett was standing at the cook with a cigarette dangling from his mouth, bowron in hand. He wore a black leather waistcoat, black beard and black glasses. He moved the carrots off to one side to warm the bowron. He was leaning back and squinting to avoid the smoke, breathing through the corner of his mouth and blowing the smoke away from his eyes with forced air from flared nostrils. Holding the bowron upside down, he rubbed the goatskin in circular motion while warming it over the flame. The frustrated Labrador barked up at the fly. Spews of steam lifted and dropped the lid off the potatoes. Steam was condensing on the window. The bar was jammed. In the bar, the musicians sat under the window with a table covered with full and empty glasses in front of them and banged out, "The chicken's gone to Scotland." Ashtrays overflowed and a fog of smoke clung to the ceiling. The two brothers and the Protestant stood with elbows on the high counter at one end, their usual spot. The brother with the waistcoat and the hat had left in rhubarb during the week. An old man with black-rimmed glasses and a black coat sat on a high stool with his back to the wall, drinking whiskey at the other end, his usual spot. He left mass early to be the first in. In between, heads and hands clamoured for stout and chatted and shouted over the music. John Mulvey stood pressed with his back to the door, gripping his pint tight to his chest. The circus man was itching to sing, and the tinker with the cravat and polio limp waited for his turn to play the tin whistle. Behind the bar, pounds were taken, the till rang and change was returned. Glasses were ploshed and washed in cold water on the spot and reused. Pints were lined up in a row, ready for the heads to be put on them. And steam rose from the boiling kettle for the awkward bastard at the hatch that wanted a hot whiskey. It's the middle of June. It's for herself, she's not 100. That old summer cold is hard shook. Jesus wept. Empty glasses clinked as they were collected by handfuls, and full bottles sighed as their caps were prized off. The optics gurgled, and a blue beer cooler beneath the counter and a beer crate in a tangle of pipes hummed to the demand. An old laundry basket filled steadily with empty bottles that clinked as they were dropped in on top of other. The old man goaded his son-in-law to sing, with round cheeks to sing, and the son-in-law started to sing a love song.
As we gather in the chapel here in Old Kilmainham Jail, I think about these past few weeks, or will they say we failed?
People jostled and stretched and turned to see the singer, and those who didn't or were too short waited patiently listening. And the volume of the chatter dropped, and there was the sound of someone slowly gulping their first fresh mouthfuls.
From our school days, they have told us we must yearn for liberty. Yet all I want in this dark place is to have you here with me.
Someone give out a scolding shh to kill the final mumbles of intense conversation of the cheek-to-cheek brothers discussing the merits of a mare they wanted to buy. They both chuckled the same way and were beefy red behind their pints. The glass washing and till ringing stopped, and pints were sucked quietly, or not sucked at all.
Oh, Grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. They'll take us out at dawn and I will die. With all my love, I place this wedding ring upon your finger. There won't be time to share our love, for we must say goodbye.
John Mulvey straightened himself, lowered his pint, closed his eyes, put out his chest, and his neck tingled as the singer's voice lowered.
Now I know it's hard for you, my love, to ever understand the love I bear for these brave men, my love for this dear land.
Others blew slowly upward, long drafts of smoke, and vacantly watched as it swirled and began to fray. Some looked studiously downward or took extra long to crush under Sol's cigarette butt, and some just picked an imaginary spot on the ceiling and stood savouring every word. And in the stillness, my mother snuck away to prod the roast, the marifat peas, the potatoes and the carrots. The Bowron player never put the carrots back and they were only half done. That bollocks and his effing Bowron. The love song wafted into the kitchen.
But when Padraig called me to his side down in the GPO, I had to leave my own sick bed. To him I had to go.
She continued prodding the roast with the big timber handle fork, and the smell escaped from the oven as the big useless lug of a Labrador salivated at her shoulder. In the bar, in the silence of the song, the stout suppers could get the smell of lamb being roasted. Then there was a loud cheer and a clap as the man with the round cheeks closed his eyes, jerked his head to beat time, and finished with all he could muster.
There won't be time to share a love, for we must say goodbye.
He then reached for his pint and his father-in-law wiped under his glasses and blew his nose loudly with a loose handkerchief that he had pulled by one corner from his top-coat pocket. The brother with the hat went to bless himself, and the musicians under the window burst forth once more to hoops and cheers and another applause, and the till rang and pints were gulped. Then, Gard Ryan, in full uniform, appeared in the door glaring at the musicians to stop. but they cut straight into another faster tune, Casey's Pig, and a loud cheer went up. That's the gangly fucker, that fella. Aye, look at the head on him, and an eye on him like a goat eating cabbage. Ryan stood in the doorway until everyone drank up and left.
Oh, Grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. They'll take me out at dawn and I will die. With all my love, I place this wedding ring upon your finger. There won't be time to share our love, for we must say goodbye.
Wait, no, maybe, did I turn it down?